create amongst ourselves and how we want to create it. And it is that mutual constitution of the city and who we are and what we are that is something which is, I think, again, very important to reflect upon.
This is The City, an hour dedicated to a critical discussion of urban issues. And welcome to the program here on CITR 101.9 FM, CITR.ca, syndicated on CJSF 90.1 FM. 90.1 FM, CJSF.ca, and available as a podcast at thecityfm.org. I'm Andy Longhurst, and on today's program, we look at the victory at Little Mountain in Vancouver's Main Street neighborhood. The recent announcement brought great news for the four remaining tenant households on the site, who refused to be evicted for a redevelopment project that is still years away. This also comes with the announcement that up to 50 social housing units will be fast-tracked and built on the site. This is a victory for the tenants and advocates of social housing. And we talked to filmmaker David Vaisbord, who has intimately documented the Little Mountain struggle. And we also reflect on this recent victory with former MLA and Little Mountain advocate David Chinovsky. You're tuned into The City, an hour dedicated to critical urban discussions. Stay with us. And on October 25th, the province of British Columbia, with the city of Vancouver, announced in a press release that these 50 units of social housing would be fast-tracked on the site. And I'm going to read from that press release and that announcement. Quote, the BC government, the City of Vancouver, and Holborn Properties have signed an agreement to allow up to 50 units to be built at Little Mountain prior to the completion of the rezoning process. The new units will be offered first to tenants that relocated off-site for the demolition and construction. The agreement also allows the four remaining households to stay in their current units and move directly into the new housing upon completion. The Little Mountain property in Vancouver, bounded by 33rd to 37th Avenues between Main and Ontario Streets, is being redeveloped into a mixed-use community. The original 224 social housing units will be replaced with 234 units and ensure there is a bedroom-for-bedroom replacement of the original affordable housing on the Little Mountain site. The new social housing units will be targeted to families and seniors. And the press release continues, but a number of these points we'll be discussing and looking at in depth from a critical and certainly an alternative perspective than what you perhaps have heard in the more mainstream media. So this will be done with the help of David Vaisbord, a filmmaker who has documented thoroughly and meticulously the entire struggle at Little Mountain, as well as former MLA David Chinovsky. And first, I want to go to some research that was published in 2010, and this is from Tommy Thompson. And in the UBC Geography Master's program, graduate program, in his thesis, The Death and Life of the Little Mountain Housing Project, BC's First Public Housing Community. And I think it's important to reflect on these findings and how they contradict often the official line from BC Housing and in many ways also from the City of Vancouver. But how is this redevelopment portrayed by BC Housing, by the province of British Columbia, the BC Liberals, as a neoliberal redevelopment project? And I read from Tommy Thompson's research, quote, opened in 1954, Vancouver's Little Mountain Housing Project was the first public housing project in BC and among the oldest in Canada. For more than a half of a century, Little Mountain provided subsidized rental housing for low and moderate income families and seniors. Throughout its years, Little Mountain was at the forefront of housing policy in BC. Little Mountain's initial development in the 1950s spelled out how the federal-provincial public housing partnership would operate in BC. In the 1970s, Little Mountain was the first public housing project in Canada managed by a Committee of Tenants. And today, Little Mountain continues to be on the leading edge of provincial housing policy, as it is the first public housing project to be privatized and redeveloped into a new province-wide policy, under a new province-wide policy announced in 2007. Redevelopment and privatization have involved the displacement of 194 Little Mountain households and the demolition of all but one of the buildings at Little Mountain. The displacement of the tenants and the near total clearance of the large site are among some of the disturbing similarities between the redevelopment of Little Mountain and old urban renewal programs of the mid-20th century. But unlike urban renewal, the redevelopment of Little Mountain is connected to neoliberal restructuring and the erosion of the welfare state. When Little Mountain is eventually rebuilt, it will feature a mixed-income community that will combine social housing tenants and market homeowners. Redevelopment has been justified, in part, on the basis that social mixing will create more social capital for the low-income families at Little Mountain. But this thesis shows that Little Mountain was already remarkably rich in social capital. In contrast to the stereotype of the troubled housing project, Little Mountain offered a very supportive, happy, and beautiful living environment. Ironically, displacement has isolated many of the tenants. Through an analysis of the distribution of benefits and losses of redevelopment to various relevant groups, this research shows that the Little Mountain tenants are being squeezed out of the benefits of redevelopment while bearing significant losses. And that's Tommy Thompson in his thesis published in 2010, The Death and Life of the Little Mountain Housing Project, BC's First Public Housing Community. And now I turn to David Vaisbord, and he is a documentary filmmaker based in the Little Mountain neighborhood in Vancouver and has followed this struggle and documented. And there is a wealth of documentation from the many meetings throughout this process, and he was reflecting on this recent victory and what it means. And if you're interested in more of David's work and the films, he's working on a number of short films as well as longer feature length documentaries. Visit vaisbord.com, and that's VAISBORD.com. And now, I caught up with David yesterday on October 29th, and we're going to go to that conversation now. So, David, you've been intimately involved in documenting Little Mountain and really capturing the whole story of Little Mountain. Can you tell me first how you came to be involved as a filmmaker in capturing this history?
For me, the decision to become involved in Little Mountain was a personal and professional decision. I came to it after many years of documentary filmmaking in the conventional sense, where you would pitch a program to a broadcaster. The broadcaster holds all the money, all the keys to financing, money for the television rights, and then various agencies funded by the Canadian government kick in money. And that system has been failing for many years and has practically collapsed, especially with regard to British Columbia and Vancouver, which is worst of all. And I was disenchanted with that whole situation. It gives too much power to broadcasters who define the way what we watch, and what they want us to watch now is reality television. So about 6 years ago, I wrote a little essay for myself, a little manifesto called The Six Block Manifesto, as a guide for my own filmmaking. And in it, I decided I'd limit what I was shooting to a six-block radius around my home. And so I told you one desire was to sort of exit momentarily, not forever, but exit from the business of filmmaking, and get into something that was more intimate and more connected with my surroundings. The second big feature was I wanted to stay home and be close to my family. My wife was pregnant, and I had a five-year-old daughter at the time, and I wanted to stay home. I didn't want to travel to work. I wanted to stay with my family. And another factor was that I was sure that I could find, within a six-block radius from my home, compelling stories to tell about people and ideas and situations that were unraveling where I lived. And finally, I guess if I wanted to make it financially viable, I'd have to do everything myself. So I wouldn't be beholding to broadcasters and fundraisers and funding bodies. and I could simply do it myself. So I bought my own camera. Actually, I didn't buy my own camera until I found the project. And the project was basically given to me by my neighbors, who told me I needed a new documentary project. And they said, there's something happening in Little Mountain. You have to go to it. You have to see what's going on. They're demolishing social housing. It's very important. I waited until my children were in daycare and in school in September of 2008. And I had a few hours, and I went, and that's exactly how it started. I just walked onto the site, looked around, and started to talk to people. And some of the first people I spoke to were very charming people who worked for BC Housing in the housing office, in the relocation office, who told me about how successful they were in finding most of the tenants and sending them off on their merry way into new and good accommodations elsewhere. Mm-hmm. And, of course, at that point, I didn't realize that my sympathies were going to quite quickly move to the other camp, where I would begin to obviously suspect the PR I was getting and move into a more critical stance. And that's a long answer mm-hmm. to your short question.
So just recently, the city and BC Housing, the province, have just announced that the four remaining household tenants will be able to remain on the site and will not be evicted, and the one remaining townhouse that was not demolished will also remain. And also, they're going to fast-track up to 50 social housing units on the site, and this has come as quite a victory for the existing tenants, as well as many other in the community who had been fighting for this for so long, I'm sure, including yourself. Mm-hmm. How do you feel about this? Is it do you see this as a pure victory, or is it somewhat bittersweet?
Well, yeah, I would say the latter. Bittersweet, because we know that there was nothing in the way, there was nothing really that should have stopped that decision. There was really nothing, that decision to say, let me start again. I think that the decision to do this should have been made phase development and phase relocation with what everyone was fighting over from the beginning. I think it's bittersweet because, yes, we've since won the argument, though the battle was lost in a way. You know, actually, maybe it's more important to win the argument. Perhaps it sets a precedent for future development. That's probably the most important thing. We have a city who is now, the city has now written a document called the Mayor's Task Force on Affordable Housing, and in that document, there's an item, number 3, which states that the city is going to be saving, I can actually read it to you. It says, task force, the recommendation number 3 is to protect existing social and affordable rental and explore opportunities to renew and expand the stock. And this task force recommendation comes after the disaster of the city not protecting Little Mountain. But I think in a very important way, that disaster has wound its way through various channels, the thought processes that bring that together, the public sphere that's digested that information and fought for housing. All these things come together and have created a really, I think, a strong argument for the city to pursue a much more aggressive policy towards saving social housing. Now, will they act on it next time? Will Heather Place be the next Little Mountain? I don't know.
Mm-hmm. For you, over these years, what have been some of the most telling or moving experiences documenting Little Mountain and the struggle to save the remaining row house, or I guess more broadly, being involved in the struggle from the very beginning and seeing the course of events? Can you just give me some idea of some of those moments in documenting it and your filmmaking that you were quite profound for you?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's been many moments for me. I mean, it's to observe those buildings becoming, getting gutted and one by one. And it all began with the fencing of Little Mountain. When I first walked into Little Mountain in 2008, I thought, oh, God, what a bunch of ugly buildings. And, you know, they ought to tear it down and, renovate and redevelop. And then I started walking on the site and I started to listen and observe. And I realized what a beautiful place it was. And when I met the people who lived there, I realized how beautiful the apartments were and how interesting, how fun the people were who were there, especially the ones who were fighting. These are the really interesting tenants who were not going to give up. The ones who weren't as, you know, I suppose weren't as browbeaten by their circumstances, weren't as fearful, people who were talking to me. But then the sadness came when the fencing started to come up and there seemed to be nothing we could do to stop it. And then one by one, I watched the buildings gutted. I went with a friend once. We snuck inside the fence and went into a building, a row house, that had been completely demolished on the inside. It looked good on the outside, but on the inside, it was torn to pieces and holes were blasted through all the walls. Incredibly depressing moments. And then when Sammy and Joan were moved out of their apartment, that was also very sad. The way they were treated by the BC Housing, it was really a textbook case in how to abuse tenants, how to demolish the community, basically with Sammy and Joan, I watched an entire community removed from where they were until they were the last tenant in the last building on one corner. This was before, this is in 2009, with no support whatsoever around them. And then without any assistance whatsoever, they're basically like, you know, hung out to dry. They were given a couple of movers who were incompetent, and the whole move was a disaster. That was very unfortunate for them. I filmed that whole process, and to me it was just disgusting to watch, but also very saddening. My wife came over and witnessed some of it. We had to bring Sammy and Joan actually home to our house on the night they were moved out, because they were left in a demolished apartment without without anything to eat and nowhere to go except another apartment that was completely unorganized, and they had nothing to eat that evening and they were alone, and it was like middle of November, end of November. That was very sad. Then Sammy's situation has gotten worse over the years with his eyesight. His recent events around his eyesight has been very disheartening. But then obviously BC Housing didn't care about that because they slapped an eviction notice on him for the almost exactly the date of his eye surgery. That's very disappointing to see and to witness. And, you know, all you have to do is go to the BC Housing website and you can read what their mandate is, and it's obviously not in their mandate to evict blind seniors who are undergoing eye surgery on a regular basis. Ingrid Steenhuisen, her mother, had a very serious fall that was partly precipitated by the way BC Housing decided to manage the demolition. And it was a very sad moment. It was a lot of them. I think every time my family moved out, it was pretty sad to know that it was completely unnecessary. And the unnecessary part is really awful to watch, especially when you know how unnecessary it was and the waste involved. And I watched it, and I watched it, and I watched it for hour upon hour upon hour. I was the only person there most of the time witnessing almost every building go down and shooting it. And that was an enormously depressing prospect. But I have the footage with which to make a long documentary feature. And I also collected the footage with which to make some shorts, which actually affected the political climate in the city. Mm-hmm. So I feel very happy that I've now done one thing with the film, and I can do another thing now. And several other things in the future, too, that are more web-based and multimedia-based.
Has the experience of Little Mountain and being so intimately involved in it, has it changed the way that you see the filmmaker's role in capturing these histories or these moments that may not necessarily be made so visible or explicit to people?
Mm-hmm. I really think that there's a lot of great documentaries to be made in many different ways. For historical art documentaries, I've done some of those. But when documentaries are about unfolding events, I think the only way to make them is with no set fixed point whatsoever. To collect the images, to put them online, some of them online, not all of them, obviously there's too much to shoot, but to put them online as we go along, and to meet the challenges that are happening as an activist or a advocate. This goes back to the earliest days of documentary filmmaking, and even John Grierson, who's the sort of father of documentary filmmaking in the world, came from an activist or advocacy background in England in the 1930s. He came to Canada, and in the 60s, from 1967 to 1980, there was something called the Challenge for Change program with the National Film Board. It was an experiment in advocacy and activist filmmaking. And what it was about taking the film to the people, shooting the film, and then showing it back to communities and helping those communities define what their problems were and their challenges. And it was very effective. It was filmmaking that was not destined for movie theaters, but films that went on the road to community centers all around in the regions where they were shot. It became too expensive eventually, and the idea of filmmaking as art, ultimately returned, because it was difficult for filmmakers to constantly sort of set aside their artistic concerns for purely social aims. But with the internet now, filmmakers can, I think, really channel their work into the public sphere without any expense whatsoever. The internet has really revolutionized the way filmmakers can make documentaries.
With the vast amount of changes happening in the world, it's almost impossible to get a clear picture of what's really going on.
We are trapped within the logic of capitalism, leaving us unable to imagine what comes next.
The Extra Environmentalist brings the perspectives of people who can see the whole picture and are ready for whatever comes our way.
Tune in to The Extra Environmentalist every Wednesday from 2 to 3 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM.
This is the viewpoint that makes all places the same to you.
How much do you know about bikes? Everything? Perfect. Nothing at all? Even better. At the UBC Bike Kitchen, you can use our space and tools to do your own bike maintenance, get one-on-one instruction on how to fix your bike yourself, or drop your bike off for us to repair. You can also buy a fully refurbished, guaranteed used bicycle, or a variety of new and used parts and accessories. The Bike Kitchen is UBC's non-profit, student-owned, full-service bike shop. We're located in the basement of the Student Union Building. Just look for the stairwell on the north side of the sub across from Gage Towers, or search for the UBC Bike Kitchen on Facebook. Stop by the Bike Kitchen and then get riding.
Despite the fact that 8 in 10 Canadians are against warrantless and costly online spying, the government remains stubborn, set to cement this scheme into law. With their huge PR budget, they've unleashed a reckless and irresponsible campaign that suggests warrantless collection of our private data is on par with a phone book. We can't let them trick Canadians. Go to www.openmedia.ca now to find out what you can do to get involved and stop this smoke and mirrors campaign the government has started.
And this is The City here on CITR 101.9 FM, CITR.ca, and syndicated on CJSF 90.1 FM. And you can find CJSF at CJSF.ca. www.cltr.ca. And also, if you're just tuning in now, live here on CITR, and you missed part of the show, you can catch the podcast at thecityfm.org, and as well as all the past podcasts are archived at the show's website. Again, that's www.thecityfm.org. And we're going to now go into the second half of the discussion on the most recent and the Little Mountain victory. We don't really have a previous victory, so this is a very important moment, and I think certainly should be seen as that. And I'm going to be talking with former MLA for Vancouver Kensington, David Chinovsky, and he was... He essentially lays out sort of the history of Little Mountain and the province's plan to privatize the land and redevelop it into a mixed mixed income site and sell it to the private developer. So we're going to go into that discussion next. But again, just keep in mind, you know, in the first half of the show, I was talking with David Vaisbord, a documentary filmmaker, and he was speaking to really the important moments in the history of Little Mountain and this ongoing struggle. And I think it's really important to be able to reflect on that history and reflect on those moments. And what does this most recent victory mean? And what can this tell us about the possibility of future victories and challenges? So all of that is important as we move forward. And again, David was gracious to talk with me, David Vaisbord, and you can find his website at vaisbord.com. And again, please check that out. And now we're going to my conversation with the second David on the show, and that's David Chinovsky. So stay with us. This is The City, an hour dedicated to critical urban discussions. Let's reflect on the recent decision. We recently heard last week that the City of Vancouver and the province, BC Housing, have come forward with a plan to prevent the four existing households that remained on the Little Mountain site in the last remaining row house to remain on the site. They will not be faced with the eviction that they were threatened with for October 1st, which then subsequently got delayed, the fact that they're going to preemptively or fast track up to 50 social housing units on a portion of the Little Mountain site. Can you tell me why this is significant?
Well, the first thing I want to say is that these are important victories. They are significant because, first of all, four sets of people are going to lose their homes. And the fact that they aren't going to lose their homes is of tremendous importance. It's important in a couple of ways. First, when people are evicted from homes they've lived in for decades and from a community that they've been part of for decades, against their will, that's a bad thing. It's a bad thing for them, and it's a bad thing for our community. So the fact that that's being prevented is terrific. The second thing is that this was completely unnecessary. Even if you believe in redeveloping Little Mountain, which I think was a good idea, it's a good idea to redevelop Little Mountain, even if you believe in the plan that was being brought forward by the province and the developer, there was absolutely no reason to move out the existing residents of Little Mountain. It's a gigantic site, more than 15 acres. The plan for redevelopment now includes a phased redevelopment. The city has said that they require the social housing, the replacement social housing. Remember, the plan is to replace the social housing that existed in 2007 and 2009 when they were demolished. So the city has said that that should be done in the first phase. So there was absolutely no reason. It was crazy to get rid of those 224 units back in 2009. It was crazy to evict these four remaining tenants in 2012. So a second reason why this is a victory is because this completely unnecessary eviction isn't going to take place. And a third reason that it's significant is that 50 units of social housing that might have waited for years and years and years and years may now be built earlier than that. that social housing that's desperately needed by people in the city. And finally, this is a victory for people who advocate for affordable housing and for social housing. You can get it. You can stand up against Rich Coleman and the BC Liberals and BC Housing and a gigantic multinational development corporation, and you can win.
Let's go back to the early days of Little Mountain, and you were an MLA for Vancouver Kensington in the BC legislature. How did this whole thing originally begin? For a lot of us, I know I moved to Vancouver in 2006, and so I personally wasn't involved or didn't know really what was going on. And I think for a lot of people, especially younger people, they don't know necessarily the history because it has been such a long and complicated and complex history. Take us back to those early days.
It's a really good point that you make. Even those of us who've been involved in the struggle around Little Mountain need to remind ourselves of where this all comes from. Little Mountain was one of the first social housing communities built in British Columbia. It was constructed in 1954. And it was one of the most successful social housing communities in British Columbia. It was a very vibrant, alive kind of community with a mix of residents, lots and lots of families. It was a family-oriented community from the very beginning. Now, 50 years later, those dwellings, 224 of them, were getting old. And there was lots of reason to think about renovating or redeveloping that site, all kinds of reason to think about that. But the provincial government, the provincial Liberal government, with Minister Rich Coleman at the helm, decided to do a particular and a very specific and a very problematic kind of redevelopment. What they decided to do was to sell the Little Mountain site, that is to privatize an asset that belongs to the people of British Columbia, that belongs to our community, a very valuable asset, in fact, 15 acres in the middle of Vancouver. They decided to privatize that, to sell it to a developer, and the deal that was being proposed was that the developer would rebuild, simply replace the 224 units of social housing. So if and when this goes ahead, we're not going to be any further ahead. We're just going to have the same number of social housing units. And according to Coleman, the developer would then be free to do whatever else they wanted with the site, and what they wanted was to build hundreds and hundreds, probably 1,500 or 1,600 high-priced condos. And with the proceeds from that sale, said Coleman, they would build other social housing. They would pay for social housing in Vancouver and other social housing across the province. So this very strange. Now think, we got to think this through. If you're going to build a stadium roof, you don't sell a stadium roof somewhere else and use the proceeds to build the stadium roof. If you're going to build a highway, you don't sell another highway and use the proceeds to build the second highway. If you need more parks, you don't sell Stanley Park and use the proceeds to buy other parks. But when it's social housing, when it's poor people, when it's people of low income, they felt fine about privatizing that site and using the proceeds and simply replacing what was already there, going no further ahead when it came to social housing and affordable housing at Little Mountain, and maybe using, I mean, that was unclear as well whether the money was ever going to be used for other housing, but that was the plan that Coleman put forward. So I was working with the community people, and they said, no, that's not what you should do. This is a big site. You're going to redevelop, build lots more social housing, build affordable housing, put in co-ops, do it in phases, make sure that you don't disrupt the life of this community, make sure that you don't demolish and destroy a successful community. The government didn't listen to any of that, and so it was my job and my responsibility to call them to account for that.
After your time in the BC legislature, you continued to work closely on advocating for Little Mountain for those tenants, those existing tenants. Can you tell me about the community involvement and community advocacy around Little Mountain from that point and into the present?
Yeah, I think that there's two pieces that I would want to talk about. The first is that there has been a process of community participation that's sponsored by the city to talk about what might be done with Little Mountain after the demolition and once the proposed deal with the Malaysian developer got done. It's important to remember that the province still owns this land. There is no deal yet. The province still owns the land. So there's been a process of consultation with the city, and what's really been unique about this process is that the people who've been mostly involved over the last couple of years are the neighbors, because the 220 tenants have been dispersed across Vancouver and across BC. There's only four of them left. So the people who've been involved, for the most part, in these discussions with the city are the neighbors. And it has to be, they have to be given a lot of credit, because you might expect, this is a middle-class neighborhood, in some ways an upper-middle-class neighborhood, you might expect that they would have just been advocating for their own point of view against a huge development that would change the character of their neighborhood. They've been doing that, but they've also said all the way through that they think that there needs to be more affordable housing on that site, there needs to be more social housing on that site, that if the redevelopment is going to mean anything, it can't just be about expensive condos, it has to be about housing that that meets the needs of the people of the city. And I've been involved in that process, and I've been very, very impressed with the principles and the ethics of many of the people who've been involved in that. So I've participated in the community meetings and the consultations and the committee that's been involved there over the last 2 or 3 years, and my input has been the input of many, many others over this period. The process has been skewed to how many trees should be there and where should the roads go and what should what view corridors should be protected in the new redevelopment, should it go ahead. And that's what the city planning department had us talking about, and what the developer wanted us to talk about, the proposed developer. What many of us have been saying is, wait a second, what are you going to build? How many social housing units are going to be there? Is it only going to be the 224? What about other affordable housing? What about co-ops? And many of us have continued to advocate for that kind of mixed affordable housing model. This could be the Little Mountain site could be a model for the kind of housing that people in the city need and want and deserve. And we've continued to talk about that. Of course, the developer has been talking a different story the whole time. So that's one piece of involvement that I and many others in our community have had. The second piece came at the time of the eviction notices, which the final four tenants got in August. And I've continued to work with those people, and they asked me if I would be their advocate at the. They wanted to appeal those evictions under the Residential Tenancy Act, which is a piece of legislation which is certainly hopelessly skewed to the interests of landlords, but there is an appeal procedure under that act, and I was asked to work with the tenants and to advocate for them at the Residential Tenancy Board, and we had one hearing, and we were scheduled to have another hearing today, October 29th, which would have determined whether those evictions went through. But fortunately for the tenants and fortunately for the city, the landlord, BC Housing, threw in the towel late last week and announced that they weren't going to go ahead with the evictions.
I want to first go back to the open houses in January 2012, and this was an opportunity for the neighborhood, the community, and tenants, I guess, to a large extent as well, although they have been since dispersed all around Metro Vancouver, to come and look at the principles or the general design put forward by Holborn and in coordination with the city, and sort of this back and forth that goes on when these major mm-hmm. redevelopments occur. Mm-hmm. And I attended, and like you said, it was largely about the design and the public realm and where the roads and the water features are going to go, and also on the type of architecture, etc. So a lot of it was focused on that aspect of it. And so then this came, was formulated after responses from the community who, if I'm correct in saying, I think it was 44% of people who attended or responded online said that they felt that what they had seen did not meet the principles. But that became a policy statement that passed City Council this past summer. And I guess, can you reflect on that process and the policy statement that we saw emerge based on this most recent round of consultation?
Yeah, I think that the consultation, there's two things to be said. One has to do with the process of consultation, and one has to do with the substance of the recommendation that came before City Council. The process is substantially flawed. The neighbors have been asked, and the residents have been asked many, many times over the last 10 or 12 years, what kind of redevelopment would you like in this neighborhood? What kind of redevelopment are you comfortable with? And their response has been the same every time. They want low-rise development, they want affordable housing and social housing, and they want a development that's consistent with the character of the community. They're willing to see, they've always said they're willing to see increased density. They've always been concerned about the community amenities that are available, community centers, transportation, all of that, childcare, all of that stuff. But their response to the question, when they've been questioned, what do you want, has been remarkably consistent over the years, dating back to the visions process that went on in the community in the first years of the decade in 2003-04, I think, all the way to the open houses that happened this year, remarkably consistent. But the process is pushes people into answering questions that are really, for many of us, tangential. They aren't the central questions. The questions, the development process is a given. It's an assumed. It's assumed that that going ahead with this kind of development, the whole of the city structures and the planning department structures and processes take it as a given that this kind of large-scale development driven by the development community is normal and what should go ahead, and that the process of consultation is just sort of talks about the edges. It doesn't talk about the central features of development. So the process itself is very much flawed, and I don't think does get at the views of the people who live in the community. As for the policy statement, it's again business as usual at City Hall. They assumed, as I said before, that it is assumed that large scale development is a good thing, that the development community's needs for profit are what drive the whole thing. And so there's a kind of negotiation that goes on between the city and the development community, but that negotiation is within a very narrow range of options. We know from having worked with the planning people at the city and talked with them over these years that the city planning department was very and has been very, very, very frustrated by the attitude of the proposed developer here. They think that their plans are over the top, the density is way too high, the proposed buildings are too high. There are a whole number of concerns that the planners in the city have, but the negotiation or the discussion or the process, whatever you want to call it, happens within a very narrow context. And therefore, you get a policy statement that's passed at City Council last June, which is not very different. It's a little bit different, but it's not very different from what the developer's asking for in the first place. I want to add one other little point here, which is a significant point, which is that there's also the impact of the provincial government and its pressure on the city. Now, I think the city has been incredibly timid in its response to the provincial government, but that doesn't mean that there hasn't been pressure. And that pressure comes from Coleman and his office, who fund what's called social housing, which is really supportive housing in the city, the 12 sites or the 14 sites that we've been talking about in Vancouver over the last 8 or 10 years, which are housing that is being built. Some of it is built. Some of it may be coming on stream as time goes on city-owned sites that's funded by the provincial government. And we know from having spoken with people over the years that Coleman kept saying to the city, you better play ball on Little Mountain, because if you don't, you won't have your money for these other social housing sites, supportive housing sites. Now, we know that that's happened. My own view is that the city has been unnecessarily timid in responding to Minister Coleman on those issues, because the residents of the city, certainly when the proposed redevelopment of Little Mountain went forward, we know that the city was warned to keep quiet and to not be aggressive on it. But at that time, the issue that most people in Vancouver were talking about, was homelessness and affordable housing. And I think the city could have been much more aggressive with Coleman throughout the piece, but they chose not to be.
I want to return to our most recent victory, and that is the victory which means that the existing four tenants will not be evicted and will be able to remain on the site, and also the fast-tracking of up to 50 units, social housing units on the site. If you were a fly on the wall in BC Housing or at the City of Vancouver, how did that happen? And what brought that on? And who was applying pressure to whom?
Well, I think that the pressure, I think that it was a lot of different things all at once, actually. I think that the fact that this campaign on social housing and affordable housing at Little Mountain continued over almost 6 years was of tremendous importance. I think a second reason, and I think it was one of the things that was calculated, was thought about and talked about by especially by Coleman and to some extent by this city people as well. I think that that the courage and the stick-to-itiveness of the four tenants, these amazing people who fought this for years and years and years, despite the fact that they are people who aren't powerful in the traditional sense in our society, who said, we're not leaving, we don't want to leave, we want to stay in our community. The fact that they fought this every step of the way was of tremendous importance. I think that another factor is that the whole thing is so completely preposterous. On the face of it, there is no reason, even if you believe in the whole plan, which I don't, there is no reason why, even if you're gonna build exactly what Holborn is asking for, there's no reason for these people to leave, because it's going to be done in phases. It's a huge site. Their new units can be built somewhere away from from where they're living now, and they can move in as soon as they're finished. So there was, just on the basis of fundamental logic, there was no reason for them to leave. Another reason why this happened is because the provincial Liberal government is very weak right now, and they don't need another scandal, and it would have been a scandal had they tried to force these people to be evicted. Some of them would have resisted, and I don't think that and others would have support other residents of the city would have supported them, and I don't think that that would have looked good for BC Housing and the provincial government. Another factor was that the city had just brought in their affordable housing plan. And one of the principles of that plan is to protect the existing stock of affordable rental. And it would have been a huge contradiction had the city gone along with, not intervened, and had these people evicted from 4 units of the existing stock of affordable rental. And finally, I think that that credit has to be given to a guy named Nathan Edelson, former planner at the city, who got involved in this struggle over the last few months, wrote a letter to BC Housing, a very, very good letter, mobilized other planners and former planners to write their own letters, pointing out to BC Housing and to the city the contradictions in their positions and that he used his influence at the city and knows some people on the board of BC Housing, and I think he pointed out to them the contradictions in their positions and helped all of this. So I think that these kinds of victories for social justice are never simple. It was mass mobilization. It was. Oh, I also think that they were a little bit afraid of the hearing that was to have happened today, because even though the law is skewed to the landlords, there was an off chance that we would have won. And we had asked that the architect and that the developer be summoned to be witnesses at the hearing, and we had also asked that they produce and bring to the hearing the secret contract between BC Housing and the developer, with that contract which they have resisted making public over all these years, and which would have told the story of what happened in the back rooms. And while it wouldn't have been likely that we would win at the Residential Tenancy Board, we might have won. There was a chance that we would win, and the whole sordid story would have been made public. So I think it's all of those things combining that made the province in particular, and the city as well, decide that something had to be done.
I don't want to downplay the fact that this is a victory and we should recognize it for that, but in the larger context, we're seeing, and we will see, likely based on when this comes up as a rezoning, the fact that we're seeing a one-to-one replacement for social housing units on a site that was, still is, but publicly owned and set aside for social housing. For public housing. In that broader context, the fact that now we're thinking about the potential for a project, and we'll see at the rezoning when this becomes goes to a rezoning hearing or an application, but they're aiming for somewhere around 1,500 to 1,600 market units and a net zero increase, nearly 234. Social housing units. Is this a huge loss to the province and to the city for having a site set aside that is held for the very public benefit of affordable, publicly owned housing taken out of the marketplace?
Well, I think that your question is absolutely central here. First of all, I think this is a real victory and one that needs to be celebrated. Two victories. First of all, they get to stay. Secondly, there's a fast track on social housing. It's a victory. We didn't have that yesterday or last week. These are real victories. They have to be celebrated, and we have to learn from them and take them as our motivation for the next piece of the struggle. Had these victories not occurred, what would have happened would be that these people would have been evicted, and we wouldn't have had the fast track of even 50 units of social housing. So that's real, and that shouldn't be underplayed. Having said that, if the plan goes ahead as it exists, then that is a terrible loss. It's a loss of public land. It's a loss of a public asset, and it's the acceptance of a plan for something that we don't need, which is expensive condos, instead of what we do need, which is affordable housing and social housing. So what I take from what's happened in the last week is motivation to continue the struggle. I don't take it as a given that what's going to happen now is that Holborn is going to get to do what they want to do. I take it as a given that that when you bring to bear all of the forces that the people of the city have, mobilization, advocacy, legal, lobbying, all of the stuff that we do, we can win. And so for me, one of the great lessons of this is don't stop the mobilization. Don't stop the advocacy. Don't stop telling the story of what needs to happen at Little Mountain. Continue to organize. Continue to demand that that site be used for what it was meant for, which is a public site for social housing and affordable housing, the kind of housing that the people of the city need and deserve. So, yes, it's a victory. Yes, it's real. Yes, we should celebrate, but we should never stop the fight for social housing and affordable housing at Little Mountain.
David Chinovsky, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks a lot, Andy.